The history of music is the history of human communication. And music. From the very earliest days of primitive, primordial Neanderthal cavemen banging the bones of dead animals upon the carcass of a burnt-out Citroen Saxo, to more modern, board game-influenced genres such as Boggle Hop and Scrabble Jazz, music has always been about one human being saying to another, "This is who me be, and how me be me." Music is a language, much like Bengalese or spoons. And, like any language that's like a language and not like one, in order to understand it, we must first understand who is using it and how it is being used. But how might we understand the language of someone or woman who might be dead, often permanently? Whilst we can understand the language of a living person through context and shouting, we can only understand the dead through what they leave behind and in front. So, how can we understand the music of the past? How do we know what it sounded like? Well, sometimes information can be left in the form of a musical score, but often this only tells us half the story, and sometimes not even half, and sometimes not even a story. And it's then that we turn to the discipline of historically ill-informed performance practice. Hello, I'm David Pockney, head of historically ill-informed performance practice here at the University of Huddersfield, and you're listening. Well done. Over and under the next half hour, I'm going to show how my department goes about solving the question of, what did the music of the back then time sound like? On the way, we'll meet just some of the many, few, incredible academics who, every day, set us back hundreds of years so that we can hear the then sounds. So, what is historically ill-informed performance practice? Well, to answer that question, we have to provide information relevant to what is being asked. And this involves going back in time hundreds of years, to the 1960s. Historically ill-informed performance practice started, much like many things, by beginning. The 1960s were a time of change and revolution. May 68, April 65, and November 61 were just some of the months in a decade which, some said, had more than its fair share. To think that these short 10 years saw not only the Cuban Missile Crisis, but the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the invasion of the Spanish Armada is almost unbelievable beyond belief. And it was in this rich and fertile soil that historically ill-informed performance practice laid dormant for 10 years before emerging and bursting into bloom in 1978, the year of soy sauce. But in order to understand how to be ill-informed, we must first, and only then, as well as later, know how to be informed. So what is historically informed performance practice? Well, historically informed performance is an approach to the performance of Western music and theatre. Within this approach, the performance adheres to state-of-the-art knowledge of the aesthetic criteria of the period in which the music or theatre work was conceived. Whenever this knowledge conflicts with current aesthetic criteria, the option of retraining the listener/viewer as opposed to adapting the work is normally followed. Music is usually played on instruments corresponding to the period of the piece being played, such as period instruments for early music, citation needed. So, historically informed performance practice involves taking the works of the past and then researching how those works would have been performed at the time they were written, then taking that knowledge and using that as the basis for how we might perform the works now. But, like any approach, this had its opponents. Probably the most vocal of these was unrepentant Dutchman and serial polygamist Geert van Oosterhuizen, who realised that the same historical inaccuracies obtained through the meticulous contextual and background analysis of historically informed performance practice could be achieved without doing any of the research. And thus, and later thusly, historically ill-informed performance practice was born. Geert's realisation provided the catalyst for a whole new wave of researchers looking into how the music and theatre of the past might be performed without the albatross of historical accuracy hanging around their neck. One of the most important of these was Timothy Balls. So, Timothy, what do you really think is the process behind historically ill-informed performance practice?
Well, I think if we're thinking about historically informed performance practice, really we're thinking about the relationship of now to the olden times. And in some ways, that's a lot like two opposites. The olden times are the opposite of now. Of course, they're not a true opposite, because that would be the future. The olden times and the future, obviously, two opposites, and we can really think about the present as being midway between the olden times and the future, almost as if it's a fulcrum on a seesaw. So we can imagine a seesaw with the olden times on one side and the future on the other. And really, the aim in historically ill-informed performance practice, or really any type of historical research, is to get it so that on the seesaw, the olden times comes up in the air. If we imagine the olden times and the future as being children on this seesaw, what we want is the olden times child to be up in the air. And what that will cause that movement is that any loose change or gobstoppers or sherbet dippers kept in the pockets of the olden times child, they will roll down the seesaw towards the centre of the seesaw, the fulcrum, which is the present, where we can grab them. And these sherbet dippers and gobstoppers and loose change are information about the olden times. And so, of course, to get that child up into the air, we need a very heavy child to be the future. And I think that's really the aim of historically informed performance practice, and that's to put a fat child in the future.
Along with Trevor, Danny Smash also made important insights into the way in which historically ill-informed performance practice might work.
The problem with, you know, historically informed performance practice is it's all about time, you know? And time is so cruel, you know? I hate time, you know? When I'm at home, you know, with my family, you know, my children, my wife, I say, I ban time, you know? I ban time in the house, you know? So my children will come to me and I say, Daddy, what time do we go to the football practice? And I'll say to them, no, there's no time. It does not exist. We go there now. And we go there, and we are 5 hours early, and they hate me, you know, and they're very bored. But I think it's an important lesson.
Well, that's all very well for the theory. But how might historically ill-informed performance practice be put into, well, practice? To find out, I travelled to Italy. Hi, I'm here at the Duomo di Napoli, here in the centre of Venice in Milan, here in the heart of Rome, and it really is an incredible building. I think one of the things that makes it such an incredible building is the fact that it's incredible. And also, it's a building. There has been a church on the site for at least 800 days, and in that period, it has probably experienced more time than any other building. There are features here at the Duomo Siciliano which are unique and can be found in cathedrals throughout the world, such as these walls, which are this incredible vaulted ceiling which prevents the sides of the building from extending up infinitely, and these windows built to a depth of 2 sunshines thick, which allow them to be used at night as well. But I'm not here to admire the architecture, as wonderful as it is, but instead to meet with a man who has been investigating the connections between this building, its acoustics, and the music which may have been played here hundreds of years ago. Michael Babylon 5 is head of acoustics, psychoacoustics, and psycho at the University of Huddersfield's Historically Ill-Informed Performance Practice Department. His work explores and does it very well. Michael, hi. Could you tell me a bit, actually a lot, about what exactly you're doing here?
Thanks, David. Well, a lot of my research is looking at the architecture of the space and seeing if, by knowing the dimensions of the space and the type of frequencies that the architecture amplifies, we can use this information for working out what types of pieces would have been played when the building was built, or just after, you know, hundreds of years ago.
And how would you go about doing that?
Well, one of the ways we're doing this is by using impulse responses, which is where we'll play a sound into the space and then look at what types of frequencies are made louder by the space. And then we can use that information for trying to work out not only what types of pieces were played in here, but also where people would have been stood, you know, both the audience and the performers.
Okay, so you can work out the pieces and the position of the players. What else can you work out?
Yeah, and it's not only pieces, of course, no. Also, the different types of instruments that may have been played here.
And I hear you have some original period instruments, so should we go and take a look?
Yeah, of course. Let's have a look.
So we're now looking at an original musical instrument from the period.
That's right.
From 1640.
1642,
yeah. It's an incredible instrument. It's this amazing filigree work on the outer case of it. It's quite fantastic. So through your research, Michael, you've been able to find out that not only was this instrument almost certainly used in this space due
That's
to
right.
The frequency makeup of the space and also the spectrum of the instrument itself, but you've also even managed to calculate the point at which it was, point in the space at which it was probably used, which he says
That's right.
27 centimetres off the
western wall,
central point in the west wall. And then not only that, you've worked out almost certainly the type of sound that would have been made. So, I mean, I have to admit, I'm dying to give this a go. So, let me just have a little play. That's a truly beautiful sound. And so, what you're saying, Michael, is essentially that, if you want to take over, there's a very specific sound that you think was
That's right.
played in this cathedral almost 500 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
27 centimetres off the west wall.
That's right.
Would you like to just give it a go?
Yeah, I'll play you this for you now. So this is it. It's beautiful, isn't it?
And that's incredible. So what we just listened to there was the same sound that would have been heard in this space, in exactly the same place, almost 500 years ago. That for me is an incredible experience. And I think this is really what's important about historically ill-informed performance practice. Well, a truly inspirational use of historically ill-informed performance practice there. Back in the UK, I caught up with Timothy Smoosh, who's a member of the Historically Ill-Informed Performance Practice Department here at Huddersfield. He's researching the music of the 11th and 12th centuries, non-inclusive, and I caught up with him at the British Library. We are here at the British Library looking at this fantastic manuscript of a musical score written in 1167. And it really looks quite incredible. I think one of the things that makes this manuscript look so incredible is the fact that it's incredible. And also, it's a manuscript. This is an original copy, and I'm wearing special white gloves because they make me feel like a princess. But I've been told I had to remove those and put on some protective ones that wouldn't damage the manuscript. So, Timothy, could you tell me a bit about what I'm looking at? But also, obviously, what you're looking at.
Right, yeah.
But mainly what I'm looking at.
So,
but obviously only when I'm looking at the manuscript, like not now, because I'm looking at you. But when I'm looking at the manuscript, could you tell me a bit about what I'm looking at then?
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, so this is a manuscript from 1167, and probably one of the most important facts about this manuscript is it gives us some really unique insight into the way in which vocal music might have been performed in this period. I think traditionally we tend to think about vocal music from this period as being quite pure, sort of influenced by what we now think of as Gregorian chant. But in fact, what this manuscript gives us information about is the fact that at that time, people would have been singing in a very different way.
So how exactly would they have been singing?
Well, I can give you a short demonstration.
And so that was a short extract of a recording of Timothy's historically ill-informed performance practice choir performing some perrotin. But it's not only academics who are involved in the world of historically ill-informed performance practice. It takes a lot of different people to make a department. So I interviewed one of those people, Barry Barfbin, who's an important member of our department. And I asked him about the way in which he fits in to the world of historically ill-informed performance practice.
I'm head of health and safety at the historically ill-informed performance practice department. And also I'm the department exorcist. A lot of people think it's quite odd to have an exorcist in a university department. But when people say that, I say, well, which is odder? Is it a university department that has an exorcist or a university department that's filled with ghosts? Well, that makes them laugh sometimes. So much of my work as an exorcist is attached to Mike Henderson's AHRC-funded project, which is called Contacting the Dead Towards a New Musicological Methodology, where he's trying to bypass a lot of the problems with secondary sources by going directly and contacting people who are alive at the time. Obviously that can be quite dangerous, which is where my secondary role as a health and safety supervisor comes in. I've been doing exorcism now for at least 15-20 years, And I'm always thinking about health and safety. I can remember one of the early exorcisms that I did. This was when I was doing freelance stuff. It was in Scunthorpe. There was a young lady who had there was a poltergeist that took up residence in her kitchen. Well, actually, it was more of a kitchenette. It was quite small. And this poltergeist had started throwing things around, as poltergeists are wont to do. And I can remember on one occasion, it threw a can of closed cup mushrooms, which quite seriously grazed her left eyebrow. You know, and ever since then, I've been very, you know, health and safety conscious about doing exorcisms. So obviously, you know, poltergeist throwing things is one thing that's quite dangerous about it. Obviously, also people slipping on ectoplasm is quite dangerous. And demonic possession, of course, as well. People say, ask me if this job is scary. And I always say to them, well, not as scary as the fear of dying alone.
London. They say the streets are paved with gold. They're not. It just looks that way because of how the sunlight refracts through the urine. Some people believe that if you take a photograph of something, you steal a bit of its soul. On a completely unrelated note, London is one of the most photographed cities in the world. Some people have a very romantic mental image of London, from the Victorian period, before the smog cleared and you could see it properly. Those are just some of the things that a jealous northern comic might say about our beloved capital city. People think that I do not like London, but they're wrong. I think it's well good. One of the rising stars of historically ill-informed performance practice is Professor Billy Bum Squiddlefarts, who's recently released a book entitled Music and London, What's the Connection? I caught up with him to find out more. So, what would you say the connection between London and music is?
Well, I think whenever we're talking about a connection between music and London, we've got to remember the size of the city, the sheer scale of it. London is the largest city in the world, with a population of just over 655 billion people. So at any one time, 115% of the world's population at any one time is resident in London at any one time. Which is even more amazing when we remember that London is actually the smallest city in the world, with a population of only two people. That's about four or five football fields. So it really is a city of contrasts.
So what would you say is the real connection between London and music?
Well, it's incalculable.
Professor Billy Bum Squiddlefarts, thank you. But of course, historically ill-informed performance practice isn't just about music. It's about theatre as well. And one of the most respected members of staff here at Huddersfield is veteran actor Sir William Buttons, well known for his controversial and often ill-informed acting choices. He's appeared in plays too numerous to mention, and when he's taken his few roles on the big screen, awards and vitriol have flowed in, not least for his portrayal of Timmy Tiny Hands in moving Irish gangster drama All the Way Down.
What are you doing, Jimmy? You're running around out there like if it's still 1992. Well, let me tell you something. It isn't 1992. It hasn't been 1992 since 1992, and even then it was only for a year. You think running around like this will bring Kelly back? Well, it won't. She's dead, Jimmy. She's been dead since the moment she died. You should know that as much as anybody who knows that. What happened to Kelly was a tragedy. There's no other way of saying it without using different words. You loved her like a daughter because that's what she was, and no one could take that away from you even though they have. But this isn't the old days, Jimmy. That's the past. This is the time that happens after that. They call it the present because it's a gift, and God didn't keep the receipt, so you better start dealing with that. You think you can kill these kids that killed Kelly, but you better think again until you think that you can, because that's the truth. These kids are different. You go after them, Jimmy, and they'll eat you alive until you're dead, and then they'll eat you dead because that's how hungry they are. They're not like us, Jimmy. They'll stop at nothing and then they'll go even further. Rules, principles, they're just concepts and words to these people. They're evil people, Jimmy, and not very nice ones either. You go after them and you're going to get yourself killed to death. You say you're doing this for Kelly. What would Kelly say if she could see, hear and smell you right now? What you've done, what you've become. I know they say that revenge is the dish best served cold, Jimmy, but that doesn't mean it's dessert. It could be an entree. But I've had my fill anyway. I'm out, Jimmy. I know you miss her. Everybody that misses her does. For going after these kids is suicide, Jimmy. And worse than that, it's killing yourself.
Sir William, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you make those difficult acting choices and how historically ill-informed performance practice might play into that.
My dear boy, when you've been acting as long as I have, you just know. I was the youngest person ever to play King Lear in the Royal Shakespeare Company. I was 7 years old. Of course, the great Sir Lawrence was also a very young Lear. He was 8, though. But he did play Othello at 2. Incredible natural acting talent. He couldn't even speak. And he managed to condense the entirety of the play down into only 10 minutes. So when you went and saw the performance, it would be a two-year-old silently looking at you for 10 minutes, but somehow managing to convey the entirety of the play, the entirety of the bard's work, in quite an incredible way, without words. And this is what I say to a lot of young actors who come to study with me. I say, often, saying the words that are in the script is doing too much. I can remember I was in a performance of the Cherry Orchard back in 1970, something rather. And and I said nothing that was in the script for the entirety of the performance. In fact, I didn't say anything during the performance. In fact, I was asleep for the entirety of the performance. And I can remember a lot of critics were quite harsh on my performance then. But I will say this is my defense, that I think that when one can so inhabit a character that one is able to convey that character's inner life on stage without even being conscious, that this is a higher form of acting. And people will say, well, that's not what the playwright intended. I would say that I think often playwrights don't know what they intend. I mean, who is to say that Macbeth should not be played completely drunk for the entirety of the performance, as I played him in 1978? People will say that Shakespeare didn't write that into the play. But I think what we have to remember is that Macbeth is Scottish. And I think the bard leaves these little clues for us for how to perform his plays.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our sojourn around the world of historically ill-informed performance practice. I hope you enjoyed it. And if I haven't converted you into a dyed-in-the-wool HIIP-er, I hope at least that this documentary will make you think twice when performing some work from the back then times. Perhaps now, instead of meticulously researching the contemporary performance practices from the time at which the work was written, you'll instead perform it based on some stuff what you made up because you couldn't be asked. Good night. A Beginner's Guide to Historically Ill-Informed Performance Practice was written and spoken out loud by David Parkney.